Guys, welcome to Knife Talk. It's a podcast for knife makers, knife enthusiasts, DIYers, anyone with any interest in forging, sock removal, knife collecting, knife whatever. I'm with you. I'm Jeff Fader, Fader Knives. Here with me is the great Mareko Momasi, Momasi Fire Arts, and Craig. Yo. And Craig is taking one for the team. He's got something going on, and we're going to cover for him. So we got us. Mareko, how are you?
I'm doing all right. The weather has been absolutely stunning this last week. This is my favorite time of the year. Springtime sunny days, because they're kind of cool, but they're absolutely gorgeous. And yeah, we hit 72, I think sometime last week, actually.
Yeah.
Recently. But we've been in mid-high 60s, and I'm like, fuck, I love this. This is premier Northwest
weather. Not having to use the heaters and having the windows open is nice.
So yeah, I love it. With you.
So I think spring is my favorite holiday, or season, favorite season.
Yeah. Well, and I've been dog sitting for a friend, and I'm getting out and walking at least an hour total a day, not consecutively, not in one hit, but, you know.
Yeah.
Walking the dog three times a day. Dude, I've burned off 15 pounds in the last 3 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Trust me, that's a lot. Well, yeah, I've got weight to lose. Trust me. I got another 30 to go, I'm sure.
The dog walking changed. We got our dog, our first dog, we got our dog like 12 years ago. And because I walked it, because otherwise, if you don't walk them, they get crazy at night. And I want them to not be crazy at night. So I take these dogs on, you know, these dogs are walking. Well, one of them isn't walking that much anymore. But we're, you know, we do at least 2 miles walking a day. Easy. Yeah, that's and great. It's huge. It's been huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
No, I love it. Yeah, some days, especially if it's a little bit, like if I'm not in a rush to leave the house or whatever, or get into the shop, I'll go on like a 40-minute walk. Easy.
That's nice.
Especially when the weather's nice. Yeah, it's great. Feels good.
It's good for you. Good for the brain.
Yeah. One, dogs are like kids, actually, honestly. I do the same thing to the kid. I'll take him to like the playground or to the YMCA so he can do some rock climbing or whatever. So he's worn the fuck out by the time it's time to go to bed. Otherwise, he's too wired.
That's more of a problem than a good thing. So, what are you working on?
I've just been working on making some steel. I got some good steel I'm playing with, and I think it's going to be really cool. It's an approach that I've been using recently. You maybe have seen it in Gabe Fletcher's work, where he's using these gradient elements to kind of create depth. In these kind of a 3D aesthetic in a 2D platform, I guess, or format, right? And he's been doing a beautiful job, and I've been wanting to do or use that element a bit more. And so right now I'm just making some random pattern material, but I have another two billets of gradient material that I have some concepts and new ideas that I want to play with that are actually ideas. They're old ideas. These are concepts that I drew up like 8 years ago that I've never done anything with. And I was just kind of fucking around with them. I use the Instagram layout app. So I'll take a picture of one, I'll draw like one square and I'll draw the pattern in there. And then I'll take a picture of it and then crop it and zoom it or whatever I got to do. So it's like perfectly square. I'll edit the photo and then I pump it into the Instagram layout app. And when I'm in my classes, like the reverse engineering mosaic Damascus classes and stuff like that, I show this tool. It's a very simple thing that you can use to build a 2x2 grid or a 3x3 grid or multiply it out even more just to kind of get a better idea of what your pattern potentially will look like. It never ends up looking exactly like it, but it does help to give you kind of an idea.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, and so I used that, and I was looking at one of the patterns the other day, and then I had this, not an epiphany, but just like something popped into my mind, and I was like, holy shit, I've never thought of that. And so I made a bunch of notes about it and drew some things out, and so hopefully in the next, after I'm done making this random, and then I gotta make some knives, it'll probably be the next pattern I work on, possibly getting it done in time for Blade Show. Yeah, stuff, fun stuff coming down the line. I'm excited about.
Well, it sounds like you're excited.
Yeah, yes. Things are a lot of changes happening in my life in general, but I'm just kind of rolling with them as best as I can, and just making good steel and cleaned out my shop the other day. Holy shit, I did a dump run. It felt so good to just say, fuck all this shit, took it to the dump and threw it away. Oh my God, my shop feels like a much better place to be.
That's great.
That's good. What about you? Well, what have you been
it's interesting because I thought, because especially Craig's not here, and I figured we could kind of talk about forging and stuff because, you know, we also on this podcast. On this podcast, we try to be, you know, it's important to not leave someone out, you know, especially when I put the questions together.
He did a class with Alex Pohl, right?
He fucked around with Steve Moonshine Metalworks for 5 minutes. Let's not pretend he's, you know, Francis Whitaker, for Christ's sakes.
I don't know who that is.
That's a deep dive. That's a blacksmith, American blacksmithing legend. So I figured, you know, we could talk about a little bit more forging stuff. We don't, you know, do heavy forging. And I've been spending a lot of time with Pat Quinn. Every 6 months I go down to Center for Metal Arts and I talk to him. I actually have Pat Quinn on, the director of Center for Metal Arts. He comes on the Full Blast podcast once a month to answer forging questions. So we've done like 10 episodes. It's been great because kind of seeing the way he works and seeing his techniques and stuff like that has been really, really helpful to me. And it's kind of changed the way I do a lot of the, you know, and he's not a bladesmith, even though he teaches these blacksmithing classes for bladesmiths where he'll teach you power hammer technique on how to forge all these different types of knives, and they don't use carbon steel. They'll use mild steel, and he'll show you. Yeah, no, just no.
Oh wait, that's right. He did wrought iron with carbon steel bit weld, right?
It was mild steel. I mean, he's not fucking around with it. I mean, I don't think a lot of these guys are fooling around with real wrought iron. It was a lot of mild steel. So they take these classes, and you know, he teaches these classes for bladesmiths, and he's not a bladesmith. And what's interesting is he's not really, he's coming from this based off of how you forge shapes and how you forging techniques that are not, he didn't learn any of this stuff from, you know, knife making classes. He learned this because I'm a blacksmith. He's been a blacksmithing educator for, you know, for over 20 years, and he's very, very, he understands how to make shapes. And so he figured this stuff out. And so it's interesting because he's using a lot of things that I'm familiar with in terms of just when I was a blacksmith and we were doing production ironwork and stuff like that. So he's been doing a lot of stuff with kiss blocks and fullering tools for a power hammer. And the funny thing is my little tire hammer I have combination dies and I have flat dies. And I'm used to, when I was a blacksmith and we were doing, you know, stuff, we were using combination dies all the time because, you know, you're trying to get as much out of heat as possible, and sometimes you don't need the flat part. You want to use the
drawing.
And I started to realize, the drawing side of the dies. And I just was like, I just started noticing they never use combo dies there. They always use flat dies with different top tools. Mm-hmm. So I dumped my combo dies, put on the flat dies, and then I started using. I have this one fullering tool. I have a couple fullering tools. One I made, it's just like a half-inch bar that I bend that I use like the cross peen of a hammer. You know?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's unbelievable. That's changed my pulling, drawing down the heel. That's been unbelievable. Yeah. And then they've been using, and I have had one for a long time, it's like, I guess it would be a flatter for lack of a better term, except for imagine an oval or imagine a circle.
Yep.
And it's cut in half. And the interesting thing so it's cut in half and there's a bar on it. And then the flat part goes on your steel on the bottom die of your hammer. And then the top die comes down and hit it. Now, the cool thing is that type of top tool is amazing for knife makers because for, you know, flattening out a bevel, when you're putting it down on the steel on the bottom die, the top die comes down and it hits the high point of the tool.
Right,
so you're not forging in parallel.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're forging with a flat die, you're forging in parallel.
Right.
But with this thing gives you the opportunity to draw out and flatten and flatten on the bevel that you're trying to forge. Mm-hmm. So he and I had a long conversation about it and I got really into it. I forged out an integral bolster this week, one and a half, and it really changed my game. And I was just kind of I thought maybe we could talk about not the Damascus, but more about the actual forging of knives and,
sure.
and the, just the basics between how you would forge knives
yeah.
and what you're looking for and tooling you like and things that would be helpful to people.
I keep it simple. I just use yeah. the flat dies. I would be very curious to get Pat Quinn's or yours or other experienced forgers feedback on the way I use the flat dies to forge blades, especially integral knives. Because I don't fuck around with any top tools. I still tune the profile and planish with my hand hammer on the anvil, but otherwise I can get 90% of the work done on the power hammer, drawing out tapers and bevels and all that kind of stuff.
Well, when you have that, just to interrupt a little bit, when Pat does the class, he says, we're not touching the anvil at all. He's using just the top tools completely.
For profiling the blade and everything too, huh?
Everything.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
He might be tuning up the profile a little bit, but everything else, he's like, I'm kind of done. I want to try to do everything as much with the power hammer as possible.
Sure. Of course. I would love to get some hot short material to him. You'd see him forge some 5200 or some Crewforge V. Rather than mild steel, because obviously blacksmiths are used to working with mild steel, but the steel we're using for blades, I guess there are challenges. It doesn't just take longer because of how much slower some of these materials, even like O1, W2, and stuff like that, move. I don't know. I feel like they pose like if I'm forging Damascus, just my like straightforward 15 and 20 1080 Damascus versus forging Crewforge V, they're like two different beasts. It's a fucking huge, but you definitely have to make some adjustments for how the alloy rich material moves versus kind of your standard Damascus steel mixture. Even if it was just solid 1084, like the hex bar. You can get from Maritime, the way it moves versus the higher alloy tool steels, it's a fucking nightmare.
Well,
sometimes
I would only say this based off of my conversations with him and the questions that we get for him.
Mm-hmm.
He never says it's about the hitting; it's always about heat management. So,
sure.
Like, I mean, they're forging now. They just finished forging anvils. And they, yeah. he knows how, you know, and these are like all 4140 steel. So they,
right.
that tool steel, don't worry about the how hard it is. He'll figure it out. But he'll never say it has anything to do with how hard you hit, or it's always your heat management. And the fact is most people are forging too cold. And you're trying to be as efficient as possible with the steel. And sometimes he'll hit a piece of steel and he's, you know, like I said, they forge with 5200 or, not 5200, 4140.
Yeah.
They're not, a lot of these guys are not hitting it until it's ice cold. You know, they're working between, where the stuff builds up scale and then, you know, it starts to get a little bit cherry red and they put it back in. So
Right. That's
part of the efficiency. And I would just say that, like, I mean, those little things about what's hard or what's not hard. I mean, I think that's not the point. It's just the idea of the material is going to move the same in terms of the techniques that you're using. Yeah. Sometimes it might take a lot longer than other times.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I'll
tell you one thing I really need to do is up my tong game, because holy shit, I've been making this steel, and I realize I would like to operate without handles as much as possible. The more I spend time making Damascus, just that way I have a lot of options in which directions and which sides and all that kind of stuff to hit the steel from. But I don't have a wide variety of tongs that allow for me to be able to hold the steel in a variety of different ways. That's one thing I could really use. I understand like the basic idea of how to forge tongs, but I have very limited experience in actually forging tongs, and I gotta do it. I gotta do more of it.
You know who's got a lot of experience forging tongs?
No, who?
Our man Ben Snure. Ben Snure just competed in the World Championship Blacksmithing event in Amarillo, Texas. and it was a tong forging competition. And he practiced, and he says he practiced, and he got it down to the way these farrier races go. Yeah. Is they're starting off with what they call lollipops. So the reins are already drawn down, and you're forging the boss to the jaws.
Yeah.
And you're popping the hole, you're putting it together, making it fit. The farrier tongs are far more advanced. I had Riley Kirkpatrick on and Ben. They both are competition forgers with the world championship blacksmithing, and that is the real races where everybody's racing for speed and efficiency and what looks the best. And Ben said that he practiced, and he made like 30 pairs of tongs. And fastest he made a pair of tongs was 17 minutes.
Wow.
All by hand, no power hammers. Yeah. These fucking farriers, they don't use no power hammers.
Oh, and they're whipping those hammers so fast and so hard. Well,
there's no need. I mean, if you're a horseshoer, there's no need to have a power hammer because to make a horseshoe, you're bumping it in the middle. There's no real way to use it. There's no real way to use a power hammer. So these motherfuckers are learning complete efficiency and fire heat. And Ben was saying that the forges were getting everything super hot. And he's like, he was working hard. He's sweating his ass off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Competition tongs.
No, it's impressive. It's impressive. I've seen some of Ben's videos of him forging tongs. And they are very impressive to watch. And well, Riley, too, honestly. Both of them are great to
watch. Those are bad motherfuckers. Yeah. You're right there. But you know where you could get some tongs if you wanted?
Where?
Texas Farrier Supply.
Oh, that's right.
Go to TexasFarrierSupply.com. They are also the providers of Indasa USA Rhino Web, but they have tongs. They have all the stuff for knife makers. They got all that stuff. And if you go to TexasFarrierSupply.com and you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you get 10% off them damn tongs. Get yourself some tongs. Get yourself some of that. And by all means, get some Rhino Wet, because Rhino Wet's where it's at. And we are all in on Rhino Wet. So, the other thing I was using was they use kiss blocks a lot. But their kiss blocks are not like, sometimes a kiss block will be like, you know, you see people clamp them onto the bottom of a thing. Or maybe somebody's got like a little contraption where they hinge on and hinge off. I used an old hammer. I held an old hammer up onto the top die, and then I used that as a kiss block, and it worked pretty fucking good. Of course, I got a German style hammer. It was an inch and a half, and nice. I wasn't hitting it hardened? That on the steel.
Okay.
Yeah, hardened. I was laying the hammer.
Don't do this, folks. It's dangerous. Don't hit hardened steel with.
I did.
Hammer.
I didn't hit. That didn't hit hardened steel. It was a kiss block, and I was using the bolster was on top of the hammer, and then I was just flattening. It wasn't really a kiss block. It was more like a block so I could flatten between the top of the spine and then
using it like a swage of some sort.
Yeah, kind of more like that than I shouldn't have said a kiss block. But
I gotcha.
Yeah, it wasn't a kiss block. By the way, my dies are mild steel. They're not hardened anyway, so I don't get too worried about that.
Okay. Yeah.
You want to get into some questions, or is there any other blacksmithing stuff, forging-y stuff you want to talk about?
I don't know. You just taught your class last weekend? Or
two weekends ago.
I got you.
Two weekends ago. Yeah, I was down at Center for Metal Arts, and it was pretty amazing. Always is amazing. And, it was really, it's always really cool seeing, they're doing some really amazing stuff down there. Every 6 months I go down there, there's always something new. So, Pat's episode was really good. We talked about how they work a team to forge these. They were forging these anvil legs, and each bar was 280 pounds. And it was like how you get these guys to get the steel out of the forge that he built. He built the forge, and how you get it out. And it's really tricky because imagine putting a 275 piece of steel into a forge. You don't want to push it one way so it hits the side of the forge, it could fuck up the refractory, and you know, you have to figure out how you're going to get it out. And it was really interesting.
The forge have like a swivel top lid and you fucking lift it out?
No, it has two sides. How they take the steel out is they have these long 12-foot bars with hooks on the end, and one guy will go in one side, the other guy on the other side, and then they'll in unison pull the same amount, and then they'll pull the steel out of the forge by pulling it. They'll pull it out, basically hooking the back and then pulling it out.
And all of this is attached to like a gantry of some sort?
Well, no. There's a gantry, and then they have a pair of tongs, and then they have these giant tongs, and they clamp on, and then the tongs get onto a chain hoist. And we talked all about it on the podcast. We in minutiae explained how you do it, and you got guys on the tongs, and you have guys holding bars to make sure that the steel is level. And then it was amazing. It was amazing to see it.
And are they doing this just kind of for funsies, for making sculpture in a way, or are they selling these anvils?
There's no funsies over there because it's like
motherfuckers don't have fun.
Well, they don't know because their compressor it's to run these industrial hammers, these monstrous hammers.
Right.
You have to have the compressor running. It's a pile of. I mean, the forge that he built. If they want to forge this block of steel, he's at the shop at 4 o'clock in the morning turning it on. So the amount of fuel that they're spending and then the amount of diesel they have to have the compressors running to run these things, it is expensive. Not to mention, you can't just grab anybody off the street to be on your team. He's got guys that he works with and they're traveling. Some guys travel hours for this weekend. And the whole thing is very expensive. But they are selling anvils. You gotta wait, but you can, they're not, I don't know how much they are, but they're beautiful. And they're the Johnston, he designed these anvils based off the bridge anvils that they're using at the Cambria Iron facility. So if you want to listen more, we've talked enough. If you want to listen more, go to the Full Bass Podcast on Instagram, listen to the last episode of Great Question with Pat Quinn. And he explains the anvils, the designs, the decisions, what it takes to run this giant hammer. It was pretty, pretty cool.
Nice.
All right. So let's hit some questions. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do it.
But before we answer questions, and we have great questions, great feedback. We have great audio questions. If you want to submit questions, especially we love the audio questions, got a pile of them. Go to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram, and this episode is sponsored by Even Heat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. All right.
Hey. All right. This one is from CSC Knives. He says, hey, guys, you probably covered this a million times. I'm still working my way through the gazillion episodes you have, but I'm working on getting clean satin finishes and struggling with J-hooks. I did a class a couple of years back with DB Blades, and his guidance managed to get a pristine satin finish. But since then, particularly struggle with J hooks in the plunges and a couple centimeters past the plunge. Any tips would be greatly appreciated.
What's worse than a J hook?
Finding a weld flaw that you can't sell the knife.
All right. Well, yeah. Okay. Touche. Well, one of the things is you probably don't deal with J hooks that much, because I feel as though I might be wrong, but ferric chloride sometimes kind of takes those away, right?
You are wrong.
Okay.
I hand sand all my blades as though they're monosteel, so they look pristine before they get any acid, because those J hooks will show, depending on the pattern. It'll vary on how much they show or don't show. If you try to like cheese it basically and be kind of like shortcut it, they will show through the Damascus. I hand sand my blades, so there are no J hooks.
So why don't you explain to this guy some techniques that he can do to make sure that he has an easier time with J hooks? No J hooks.
Yeah, I think go ahead.
I was going to explain, if you're listening to this and you're wondering what a J-hook is, when you're sanding, so when we talk about a satin finish and we're hand sanding our blades, we're trying to get the satin finish lines to go from the plunge line towards the tip, so you have lines. It's like a belt finish would be from the spine to the edge. A satin finish would be from the plunge line to the tip. And what happens is because it makes it look like a human did it. It's hard to do a satin finish with a plunge line. So what happens is when you're going back and forth with the sandpaper, if you go back and forth too many times, there'll be an errant pull, and then you'll end up with this little kind of U-turn, fuzzy, tiny scratch, and that's a J-hook.
Yeah. Yeah. So I scrub my blade to get all of my scratches to where I want them. And when I start pulling stroke lines at the very end, so there are no J hooks and everything has a really nice, or is all the scratch lines from my sandpaper are flowing down the length of the blade. When I'm pulling those last pulls, my hand sanding stick is maybe 3/4 or 7/8 of an inch wide. And so, but what I'm doing is I'm trying to only catch one edge. So if you think about the whole width of the face, I'm not trying to set the whole face down at once and pull a stroke. I'm catching kind of the far corner, the corner or the edge that's away from me. And I'm trying to have essentially a single contact point by at which the sandpaper is making contact with the blade. And then I pull a stroke. And I might pull just a couple strokes and then I'll change the paper or adjust the paper a little bit. So I'm using fresh paper again. And then I'll just keep doing that. And I'll keep doing that until everything's looking really nice and pretty. I think when I first started hand sanding blades out, when I first started making knives, J-hooks were a huge pain in the ass. And it's because, at least for me, I was finding that it was because I was trying to set down the whole width of the face of that hand sanding stick all at the same time. But both edges basically are kind of catching and sanding in the face at the same time. But they don't, in my experience, they don't wash each other out or blend each other out. I've found that the only way I can get really good hand sand finish and stroke and pulled stroke lines is by just having that one edge that I'm catching and pulling the stroke line down, whether it's from plunges or from your integral bolster, wherever it is, or from the bottom of the ricasso where it transitions into the hidden tang or into the tang in general. Just having that one edge. And I only do that when I'm pulling the final strokes. Otherwise, I'm scrubbing using the whole full face. And actually, as I'm, I guess it's not necessarily correction, but just more detail. So I set down and I'm only have that one edge catching. But then as I pull the stroke, I slowly kind of set the whole face down. And so that by the time, instead of starting from a dead stop with the full face of the blade or of the hand sanding stick on the blade, I start with the one with the back edge and then I slowly kind of rock it down so that then the whole face is engaged. But as the hand sanding stick is moving down the length of the blade.
I thought you were going to say that when you pull it up. So that last corner, the last, you're facing, your outside corner of your hand sanding stick is almost rolling.
No, I start at the bolster and the heel, and then I
roll. No, I'm just saying that when your final pulls, instead of just going straight out, we go up. So that last bit, the corner of the hand sanding stick is engaging the face instead of the whole face of the blade. So the whole face of the stick. You're right. I'm not going to confuse everybody. I would say that one thing about J hooks is a lot of the time, if when you're going down your progression of sanding sticks or sanding grits, you maybe if you're you're working with 120 grit sandpaper, if you have J hook 120 grit sandpaper with J hooks, you're not going to get them out with the 220. So some of these older J hooks, you got to make sure the J hooks are out before you get to the next sandpaper. Otherwise, I think that's one of the biggest problems with the satin finishes is people go full blast with the coarsest, and then sometimes they have a problem getting out some of that J hook. The J hooks are really tough to get out because they've already kind of dropped up to 400 grit and they can't get the J hooks, the 120 grit J hooks out.
Yeah, and unless you're like really scrubbing. If you're just pulling strokes, it's going to be really hard to get those out. And like you're saying, you got to get them right at the lower grits before you move up to the next ones. And if you notice them at the next one, then you fucking just drop right back down, get them right, and then go back up.
I think I said this last week, but we've started going with a higher grit starting sandpaper. Because I feel as though I try to do as much as possible on the disc sander to kind of take those peaks off. So once again, for all you guys to know is when you see a satin finish, what you're looking at, if you looked at the with a microscope on the side, you'd see that they're valleys and their peaks. And then so when you're looking at the satin finish, the shiny parts are the peaks and the darker lines are the valleys. So if you want to, so what you're trying to do is you're trying to remove those peaks to make sure that there are less of those dark valleys, and then you end up with the satin finish that you're going to like. And it's really up, it's your preference, honestly. So we're starting off, and I like I said, I think last week is Jeremy Spake was saying to me, he's like, yeah, I was talking to some older guys, and they were saying start hand sanding at a higher grit, and then you will have, you won't have as deep a starting point of your satin finish scratch lines.
Right.
So I've been doing that. We've been doing that a lot. And then, frankly, for J hooks, and this might we start with the mold polishing stones, 220 mold polishing stones, and then we do all the rest of it with the sandpaper. And I think that's become really good for us.
Yeah.
And then, in terms of J hooks, one thing that does help, and this is, I know you don't use any kind of lube, but WD-40 or Windex on those higher grits definitely helps prevent the J hooks. I don't know why that is, but Windex for sure, especially at 400, 800, kind of negates it. I don't know, makes you not shake. I don't know what the fuck, because J hooks like almost like a shake. You know, it's almost like your fucking hand move weird. So it's like, I don't know why it is, but like you put a little WD-40 on there on the higher grit, on the lower grits, and then the Windex, and you're less likely to get the J hooks.
Hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. And then we finish with Scotch-Brite. Scotch-Brite also.
Yeah.
I like those Scotch-Brite.
It's a strong move. Yeah. I'm doing 400. I try to start at 400 grit. Yeah. And then I do all my scrubbing and then pull strokes at 400. With a dense rubber backer, and then I have just like you can get this like dense felt for like putting on the bottom of furniture and shit like that.
Yeah.
And I use that as a backing for pulling strokes after that, so I have a little bit softer of a backing. And then I go to the Scotch-Brite, and it finishes out with like a really nice like kind of, it presents as like a satin 800 grit finish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely much more mute. It chills it out a little bit. Well, chills those lines out a bit.
Yeah. Well, and the etch, like it, like I find as a low of a grit finish I can get away with that still looks absolutely like really good, the better my etch holds on my blades.
Huh.
The contrast. That's
interesting.
Yeah, my idea is that there's like a little bit more kind of like texture, topography there. It still looks, but you don't want to go like 120 or two, even 220 is too rough. It just doesn't look right. But yeah, if you can get a really nice satin 400 that presents as a 800,
nothing wrong with that.
No, it's gonna look good. You don't have to go. You don't have to hand sand to fucking. Till oblivion, and then and you can get a really great high contrast etch that holds really well. And I find that with the coffee finish, with the coffee etch, the lower the grit finish you can do, the more stable the finish, and the easier it is to get high contrast.
I don't know. I'm amazed that people start hand sanding. Well, that's my problem. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about what I was going to ask. I was going to just say, I feel like sometimes people are hand sanding off the belts at too high of a grit off the belts. And it's like, why is this taking me so long? Well, you finished grinding off the belts at 120 grits, and now you're using 440C stainless, and you're just going to, how come this is taking me 8 hours to do it? I'm like, well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why swapped it. We stopped. So 440C, it was too difficult. Cause then what happens is if it's too hard, you start to say, well, I can't start hand sanding at 400 or this shit. I'm going to be here till my life is over. So, you know, so what happens is you end up using, all right, I'm going to start this scratch pattern with a 60 grit. The next thing you know, you have like trenches. You know, your satin finish is like, it's almost like impossible to get them nice. So we that's why we use AEBL these days.
Yeah, Yeah, and I'm before I start hand sanding at 400, I'm coming off the machine at 400.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that really helps.
Well, I think that was a pretty good answer. What do
I
you
think we
think?
did it. That was good.
All right. We
Who's this
have
next
an
one?
audio question.
Is this our
Audio
friend from
question.
Australia?
I don't know where he's from, but let's find out. This is Adel Knives. Adel Knives has reached us on Instagram. He DM'd us and he sent us a message, and it sounds like this.
Hi guys, this is Andy from Adel Knives in God's Own County of Yorkshire.
Nope.
Last week you spoke a lot about heat treating of billets for stock removal. But I've just got one more question on that. You talked about normalizing cycles, grain refining, hardening, and tempering. But where in that process do we do the profiling and initial bevels? Would you do your normalizing and grain refining and then do profiling before moving on to hardening? Or does profiling come first? I bought myself a couple of fancy billets, and I don't really want to fuck them up by getting this wrong. Thanks a lot, guys.
That's a way to ask a question, dudes. Guys, listen to Adel Knives. Clear, concise, good.
What do you
Can't get
think?
much better than that. What do I think is, I'll tell you what we do. I would, if we're going to normalize, all right, if I forge the knife, I will normalize. Then I'll put in some, I'll clean up after the three sets of normalizing. So I'll go over critical temperature, and below critical temperature. And then I will grind, touch up the profiling. Then I will grind in some of the bevels. If I'm oil quenching. If I'm oil quenching, I'll grind in some of the bevels just lightly and leave a little bit of material to get rid of the decarb and whatever cleanup I have to do. If I'm doing stock removal, plate quenched, stainless, I'm not going to put in the bevels because I want to make sure that when I quench in the plates, that the knives are straight when they go between the plates. That's a big problem if you put in a distal taper and you put in a big bevel and then you're putting it between plates, the plates aren't engaging the whole blade. And because it's not parallel anymore, if you put them in weird, it can bend. If you put them in too, if you push down in a strange way, all of a sudden you get a warp. So it's not flattening straight. So if it was, if it's stock removal, I'm quenching straight with plates. What do you think?
Yeah, so if I am forging blades, let's say like when I was doing primary grinding, so I would forge my blade, I would dial in the profile, but it would still be pretty thick and th much thicker than I would want to heat treat at. And so I would say I would probably do the normalizing and grain refinement at thickness because it doesn't have to cool down quickly, right? And then I would do my primary grinding to kind of remove stock, to get down to my heat treating dimension of my material. And then I would, let's see, I would probably do a subcritical anneal cycle, which is bringing, excuse me, bringing the steel up to about, oh, I think it's in Dr. Laren Thomas's book. I think it's like 1485 or sorry, 1385 or something like that. Which is the abbreviated subcritical anneal. So 1485, let it sit for like half an hour at that temperature, just to help relieve any stress that it might have the material might be experiencing through the stock removing or grinding. To help like relax the steel again, it basically, and also to spheroidize any carbides or whatever that are in the material,
What does that
and
mean?
sphere. So it's so, or I guess it would be spheroidizing perlite. It's I don't it's a
All right.
I don't
Well, I just
you,
this guy, I don't want to confuse this guy, so all
okay.
right.
So anyways, yeah. It's in Dr. Laren Thomas's book. Actually, he also has these articles on annealing and the effect of and normalizing and grain refinement, all this stuff on his website as well, knifesteelnerds.com. And then I would go into my final hardening from there. And
But
honestly,
in
if I was
between,
doing, wait, sorry, what?
but he's doing stock removal, so you would, you would pre-grind between the normalizing and spheroidizing and the subcritical anneal. Then you would pre-grind and then you would harden.
I would do my normalizing grain refinement, then I'd stock remove, then I'd do the subcritical anneal.
Okay.
And then I would do my final hardening.
Ooh, I like that. That's this guy, this is what this guy needs to do. Don't that's what you need to do. That's how you do it. Normalize, then you do the profile, then you do your spheroidizing. I love spheroidizing. All about the spheroidizing, and then
making those little balls.
Then you do the hardening.
Yeah,
I'm down. If you were to grind your knives, Mareko, as you grind your knives, what machine would you use?
I don't normally grind my knives, but when I do grind my knives, I use my Broadbeck.
That's it.
Yeah, I use my Broadbeck. I love the machine, and I really appreciate those guys and everything they do for our community. They've built a great machine that is it has so many uses. It's kind of crazy, actually. I think they have something around like they're coming up on 12 different attachments for that damn thing. They got a lot going on. If you want more information, go to the website, broadbeckironworks.com. Check out their packages. Check out the tool arms. Maybe if you already got a chassis, but you want one of those tool arms, they usually have designed them so they can be cross-platform. So they can be actually used on other machines. And so when you go and whatever you get from them, just make sure you're using Knife Talk 10 at checkout to save yourself 10% at broadbeckironworks.com. Again, it's Knife Talk 10 at checkout to save yourself 10%.
Let's do some questions, and then we'll do some listener feedback. This next one comes from our friend Dylan Myrick. Dylan Myrick says, here's a question. I'm 20 plus or minus knives in, and I'm battling some poor bolster grinding I've discovered while hand sanding. How many knives did you guys make before you caught the make it perfect bug, and how far is a mistake worth chasing? This knife is kicking my ass, but that's how the learning is done. Peace and love from... Day one aluminum star listener. Day one aluminum star listener. Dylan Myrick, when did you start to get the perfection bug and blah, blah, blah?
Perfectionism?
Well, I mean, he's like, when did you make it the make it perfect bug and when do you let it loose?
Ah, yeah. I've talked about it before. I've actually probably struggled with perfectionism all my life, and I think that goes into other shit regarding just being generally like accepted by other people. But I think it definitely kind of translated into my work, especially as more people were seeing it. I was like, oh, I got to make it even better than the last one, or even more perfect than the last one. And I think that's an unrealistic metric. I think you definitely want to make small improvements ideally along the way, and especially as you become more and more experienced in knife making and develop your skills and talents to a level, those little growth points become smaller and smaller, but I think it's really important to keep looking for them. But I think especially on earlier knives, you have an opportunity to kind of take that time, not necessarily to make it perfect, but to kind of experiment with techniques, to refine your techniques so that as you continue to develop as a knife maker, as you continue to build your brand and the awareness of your work and start to sell more of your work as a maker, as you get more of that demand and sell more work, you're selling work that you feel confident and comfortable selling. And honestly, like, I've probably trashed more than 20 knives because I fucked them up somewhere along the way. But I use those when I make those mistakes, and it's painful to make those mistakes. I try to learn as much as I can from those mistakes so that when I move forward, I can do better on the next one. But I think that's about all you can really do.
That's a good answer. I feel as though a lot of knife makers are making knives for other knife makers to praise them for, as opposed to what the customer wants or cares about.
Sure.
Like, I'm always surprised at how it's almost like, look what I'm selling, But then they're really mentally saying, hey, knife makers, how's this? As opposed to
approval seeking.
Like, yeah, it's approval seeking from, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I remember when Dan Quisenberry was a fucking great pitcher for the Royals years ago. That's for okay. that's for you, Fiery Ice. Fiery Ice knows what
Canadians
I'm talking about.
Dan
Quisenberry. No, if the Royals are from Canada. Not from Canada, from Kansas City Royals.
Oh, they are? Oh, shit.
Yeah,
sorry.
Kansas City Royals. So Mike Quisenberry kind of like sent me a nice message. I'd never talked to him before. I was like, whoa, this is amazing. And Mike Quisenberry is my hero, and this is unbelievable. And I'm getting a nice, you know, unsolicited compliment from a person I respect. Those are awesome feelings. But at the same time, there's a lot of master bladesmiths. I'm not talking about Mike, but a lot of master bladesmiths who make a culinary knife, and it's like, this is for fucking chopping trees. This isn't for, or, you know, it's just like, you have to also understand what your customer wants and what you're trying to get across. I feel as though it's something that you have to work through. 20 knives is really like a drop in the bucket. Like, talk to me in 100 knives, and then you'll start to kind of like, you know, the best thing you can do is just, you know, acknowledge them and then make sure it doesn't happen again. That's growth is like seeing what you did, seeing what doesn't work, and then going on from it. The best part is, and this is something we kind of touched upon last week, but I mean, at the same time, it was more along the lines of, you know, for years people sent us messages saying, oh, I see my knives that I made a few years ago and I'm so embarrassed. That is a milestone in your life based on the experience and techniques that you had at the time. You can't go back. You can't, as Craig would say, I want to like give a systems update for the old stuff. Can't do it. You have to understand and respect that those things are milestones in your experience. And as you grow, you get better. And then you have to have the mindset the next one's always going to be better. And then that's what happens.
Yeah.
There you go. Look at that. I mean, that was a nice answer.
That was good.
You know, want me to give you another nice answer? You know where I go when I want to get all my Damasteel? I want to go to Maritime Knife Supply. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Maritime Knife Supply is your one-stop shop for knife makers, steel belts, abrasives, handle materials, tongs, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. They sell everything. Lawrence is a knife maker, so he knows what you need. And if you're in Canada and you he doesn't have something you want, send him a message and he will get it for you. And he is also the sole provider, if you're in the United States and Canada, of the steel for the Damasteel Invitational. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Damasteel. It's damasteel.se. They are doing the Damasteel Invitational again and the build-along. The steel's ready to go. Lawrence over at Maritime is already selling it and is ready to go. They are going to be selling a foot-long bar of RWL-34 to create a culinary blade plus a piece of Helmspringer to create an accompanying piece or feature to the culinary knife. Let your imagination go crazy. It could be attached or not, but it must be included in the picture. There will be prizes and awards, the Damasteel Build Along. There's the Knife Talk Choice. That's our burden to choose. There'll be Pair's Choice. Alfredo Facci Pieri will also be joining as a judge for the best mirror polished blade. Go to DECI@Damasteel.com to submit your photographs before Halloween because you got some time. And go to Maritime Knife Supply to get all that steel and other things. Support our friend Lawrence. I'm with him.
Did you say DECI or is it DCI?
DCI.
Okay.
DCI. Okay. DCI. Lost it. Yeah, DCI. You know, go to Damasteel and then they'll have all the information on the Damasteel Damasteel Build Along at damasteel.se on Instagram. So we have some listener feedback. If you want to do that, you want to do some more questions, listener feedback, guys. We're going to do a couple of listener announcements just because we're here. If you want to submit your questions or feedback or all that stuff, go to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. That's where you can interact with the show. Listener announcements: T Frank Customs has a May 17th. He's got a hammer in. Go to thomasfranklinknives.com or gmail@gmail.com. Send him a message. If you are in Fort Smith, Arkansas, reach out to T. Frank Custom Knives for more information on that. Ferromorphics has a show going on, the Bladesmiths of the Blackstone Valley. Ryan Brewer, Matt Brovart, Josh Prince, all these guys. April 3rd to May 1st. So hurry your ass up.
I've seen some posts about that.
Yeah, I see some posts too. It looks good.
Looks pretty cool.
In Worcester Center for Crafts Gallery. So get yourself, follow Ferromorphics for more information. But our man, Josh Prince, saw him. I saw Josh a couple of weeks ago. He was teaching a pizza cutter class. That was really cool.
Yeah.
STP Custom Knife Collections has another event in September 13th and 14th, the Louisiana Custom Knife Show in Gonzales, Louisiana. Tables and booths available at www.lacustomknives.net. And last but certainly not least, Can Iron. Those knuckleheads in Canada are doing it again August 7th through 10th in Austin, Manitoba. Pat Quinn, Jake James, Lee Arapach, Noah Vachon, among others, will be at the event. And it is sponsored by our main man, Maritime Knife Supply. Lawrence Lake is supporting it. Go to caniron.ca for tickets and more. There's camping available. There's going to be food trucks available. There's going to be awesome demonstrators, and it's going to be a hoot over in Can Iron once every 2 years. Okay, that's enough of the announcements. All right. We have eyeball feedback. Last week, if you were listening, Mareko got some gunk, some scale in his eyes.
Poor
He's all better. Are you all better now?
Yeah, it's all better now.
You're all better now. Well, we have some eyeball responses. This one comes from our man C-3PO, aka Leonard Lee. Here's a story about getting my grinder stuff in my eyes. I'm not doing that anymore. I was helping my dad replace his cast iron gutters. We had to take it off the grinder. I was on a ladder, wearing safety glasses. Nothing wrong at all. Ha ha ha. We stopped for a cup of tea. I took off the glasses, rubbed my eyes, which I managed to push metal shards from the side of my face into my eyeball.
Oh.
Tried washing them out. Ended up having to go to the hospital, where the doctors told me the good news was the specs were rusting, which made them quite easy to see. Now I have 3 scars on my eyeball. Nothing serious. Just don't worry. So remember, safety gear doesn't stop you from being stupid. So motherfucker C-3PO pushed some of them shards right up into them eyeballs.
Yowza. Been there.
Yowza. Yeah, I'm against it. I remember seeing people get stuff removed from their eyeballs. Yeah, it starts to rust and it turns like kind of like it's like a grappling hook in your eyeball.
Yeah.
Not nice. Brian Rockin, our man from France. He said, just listen to the last episode, short story. I got a piece of steel in my eye too. Spent a day working with it. Not annoying at all. I go to the pharmacy asking if they could clean out my eye. She looks to say I should go to the hospital. Go to the hospital, see a specialist. He tries to remove the steel, but it seems stuck in my eyes. He pulled on it, and I can't explain the feeling, but it's like he tried to remove my entire eye.
Yeah.
Not a success. Sent me to another specialist.
Oh my God.
Then he used a Dremel-like tool to remove the steel and all the part in the white eyes. So it started to rust because it was steel. Conclusion: use glasses or grind stainless steel to avoid rust in your eyes. Peace.
Yeah, from what I understand, I remember hearing this a long time ago because my stepfather, a long time ago, worked in a wood shop, and he got a piece of wood in his eye, and he just like toughed it out. And he went to the hospital after work, and they're like, "You just barely got here in time because the eye heals surprisingly quickly, or whatever." Anyways, and so it almost healed over. And so I imagine that might be why it felt like he was pulling on his fucking eyeball. Jesus Christ. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as soon as you get something in your eye, get it the fuck out if you can.
The only eye problem I ever had was I had welding blindness and it wasn't because I was like closing my eyes and welding. It was because I was sitting on a high stool and I was TIG welding, and the arc, I was higher than I should have been. If I was lower, it wouldn't have been a problem. So the welding light bounced off my chest into the inside of my mask and then into my eyes. So I was welding all day. And that night I woke up, it was like sandpaper, and I couldn't see. I couldn't close my eyes. So that morning I made it to the eye doctor, or just the pharmacist. And then I went to an eye doctor and they were like, yeah, you basically flash fry your eyeballs. Luckily they're okay. But I mean, you know, if you look up, my eye doctors always tell me how they look up tight. They look like shit. You got that microscope up in there, they like look like a fucking pair of bacons. You know, put some bacon in my eyeballs.
Christ.
But yeah, not nice. But that otherwise,
old bacon eyes.
Old bacon eyes. Next one comes from, this is an audio message from our man Justin Stinson, Running Man Forge. He wants to talk about our conversation about art.
Hey guys, it's Justin from Running Man Forge. I think art is a spiritual pursuit. I think that's it. Like, Jimi Hendrix had no formal training in playing guitar, but you know he played with his spirit, and that's all it was. So I think artists doing a great painting are being immortalized by AI art, because we get to see the soul of that person's art being transformed into many different likenesses. And it doesn't matter if the person's name is attached to it, because the universe knows. That's all I have to say about that.
The universe
Hell
knows.
Oh, yeah, brother.
Justin Stinson, I'm with you, but not with that answer, my guy.
You're gonna stick to your gatekeeping?
Not the gatekeeping part, but the AI part. I got a problem. I'm with you. If it's a spiritual pursuit, I know it is it's a personal thing. But when fucking Junior with his computer starts to steal your shit, you are out. I had a long conversation with Jeremy Spake about this. He's hot and under the collar about it too. But he says all these, there are going to be no commercial artists at all with this AI art. You're gonna run people out. So I would see that. I'll take the art is a spiritual thing and it's a personal thing, but I would never do anything to steal it from you. I would never steal that beautiful moment from you, Justin. I want to protect you and your spiritual moment, and I don't want it to be stolen from you.
Damn right.
So that's a much more calming answer, I think. I don't want him to be stolen from. Anything to add?
No.
All right. Well, let's keep going then. Another one comes from Nick Alpin. We're starting to get Magna Carta time with some of these guys, so I'm going to kind of race through them. There will always be a place for appreciation of human creation, works by Picasso, Caravaggio, Da Vinci, etc. will never lose their value and forever be treasured as expressions of the human soul. The height of accomplishment, nothing can replace or devalue them. AI, quote, in the style of creations are novelties and democratizes art to a degree and allow social media drunken public the joy of creation for a fleeting moment. These people can claim to be artists. I can also fart and call myself a trumpet player, but neither claim has validity. I work in tech and experience firsthand how that world is moving quickly despite this. There is already a revolution led by young generation against tech in the form of resurgence of vinyl records, film, photography, which I shoot for. Okay. Kudos to the knife and kudos to KTP for having these discussions. For Jeff's passion to return to art in 2025, fewer things are more punk rock than putting a brush to canvas, hammer to steel, film to chemicals, etc. This is indeed a germ-infested planet. You are undoubtedly the best. And I will steal a direct message from my man Jeremy Spake, and he listens to these things, and I don't think that he will mind me. Part of the things that one of the things he said to me in this message, he says, I really don't think in terms of setting they are really not thinking in terms of setting precedents to how these things snowball to the future. There will be zero people making a living doing commercial art, jobs that are bread and butter for people who earn a living doing art. And then there was one more thing he said that I thought was pretty interesting. In regards to these filters that my man said were okay, he says, this stuff has incentivized by, wait a second. Here it is. There will be less of a financial incentive to bother learning how to do anything yourself. The art will consist of the tippy top elites, and these fun fads are insidious and are an intentional scheme meant to give folks who have nothing to lose the tools to kneecap those who have everything to lose. Mm. I like that, Jeremy Spake, ladies and gentlemen. Don't fuck around with him.
He'll sick kneecapping you.
He don't fuck around.
Do you think that these artists who feel like they're losing jobs, that they should make art that can't be as easily replicated?
Well, a lot of it is also what he was saying, and I didn't even dawn on me, is that, you know, a lot of people are commercial artists. You know, they're actually doing stuff. They're doing a business for a living where they're using their artistic expertise to make stuff for commercial art. So he's like, I mean, that's part of it too.
So would you consider them real artists, or are they an inefficient form of AR?
I don't do the whole real artist versus non-real artist. I think that
you don't.
No, I think there's successful art and there's not successful art. And I think that I should have probably said delineate between fine artists and other artists. So I guess I probably think of things of more like, you know, somebody who's a, you know, they're professional artists, that they're fine artists, and you take commercial work on. I have a good friend of mine who's texting me right now about the fucking Knicks. Guy's one of the best painters I know, and he works in graphic design for book design, and he doesn't want to do it, but I mean, allows his technique and stuff allows him and his skill allow him to work in a commercial level of you know, utilizing his skills to pay the bills.
Right.
And you know, I don't fault anybody for that, you know. So I just, you know,
do you think AI art potentially could be categorized or reframed in a way like a style of art, like cubism impressionism or whatever the fucking style Monet, or was Monet impressionism? I can't remember, but anyways.
Here's what I would say.
Because there were many artists that would paint in that style. They had their own stuff that they were doing, but they had a particular style that they were all kind of, or a group would be using, not all of them, but these were techniques that people would use. And use over and over again, right?
Of the digital art that I like, and somebody said to me, he's like, well, you know, back in the day, you know, digital artists were frowned upon. I think it might have been Craig. There's certain, you know, what I was talking about Bantam Tools is doing with these, you know, these plotter art ideas where people are creating very specific algorithms to make these pieces of work. I think there's validity to that, especially when you can talk about the decisions that you're making. I told the story. I was at an AI art meeting, AI art opening, and I went in there all relatively pissed off, and I wanted to talk to one of the artists, and I said to him, tell me about your work. And that's a softball question. Like, you know, you ask me my work, I'm like, oh, I'm dealing with this, I'm dealing with that, I like color, I like this, this comes from a place of that. That's a normal softball question. I asked this fucking guy, tell me about your work, and it was as if I asked him to, you know, let me see your dick. You know, he freaked out. And to the point where he didn't know what to say, and then faked a phone call with his girl. I got to take this call with my girlfriend and walked out of the room. And then I talked to my friend.
Then he got in his car and drove away.
he just left the room. He left. He's like, oh, my girlfriend's calling. I got to take this call. It's a bullshit. So to the point where I talked to the guy who organized the work, he's like, yeah, a lot of these guys are making NFTs, and they realized that they could make a couple extra bucks by making this AI art. So some people don't give a shit. So like a guy like that, who they're famous guys making this digital art, they're full of shit too. You know, like if you can't talk about your work, like you're the level of, you know, I mean, credibility is one thing or the other, but you know, you leave it and you're like, guy's full of shit, and then you don't think about him anymore. Mm-hmm. You're not like calling the cops, you know, but at the same time, I mean, there is something to be said. I mean, look, nowadays, and I'm saying this with peace and love, peace and love, peace and love, I'm seeing so many knives out there that look like a Montana Knife Company knives. I'm kind of stupefied. And that isn't an AI art thing. That is like people making the decision to say, you know, the people like the Cerakote blades with these kinds of scales and these kind of I mean, it's like at some point we need to have some degree of, you know, culpability for this stuff. And I think that when you're using those filters, it's the same thing. It's not shouldn't be illegal or anything like that. You do whatever the fuck you want. You live your life. But at the same time, you are watering down. Well, I agree that these simple little things are insidious. So they desensitize us to, you know, bigger fish to fry.
What would you say to a quadriplegic that might finally have a way of being able to create, bring into the world what is bouncing around inside of his head?
Why do you say bouncing around with a quadriplegic? Why would you do something like that? That's outrageous.
Throw him wheels,
are you trying to make it some sort of joke here?
That's a bad joke.
I made the bad joke, but I, what is his name? Matt? That was an old joke. Sorry, that was an old joke. That's bad. It's a bad joke. Terrible. I say go for it. I say however you can express yourself is fine. I think that ultimately this is just a nothing to write home about thing. It's very clear that the writing's on the wall and we're just going to just devalue more people and their jobs. So that's the future. So we have to figure out ways in which to make sure that we're not, our shit isn't diluted. So, right. You know, make your shit not diluted.
Well, I mean, do you feel like it's in line with automation, like factory automation?
To a certain degree.
There used to be people working in factories. Now, those weren't, do you feel like, I mean, skilled labor, I guess, maybe. Do you think some of that was not necessarily skilled labor versus just straight up labor, like just sliding sheets of metal around? Or
great question. Great question. I'll tell you my opinion about technology, and I this would probably turn me into one of these, you know, crazy people who hate, you know, the future. I love the future and technology. I always worry about people's careers and jobs and how they're going to feed their families. So I'm a capitalist, clearly. I'm more of like a consumerist. Like, I believe in all, let's all rise together. That's why I haven't bought a laser and I like using IMG. It would be very easy for me to just get a laser. I would have paid for it already. I like using Patty over at IMG to get my stencils made. I'm going to still use it. I like using the guys over at New Jersey Steel Baron. I like using Maritime Knife Supply and ours. I want everybody to, I don't want there to be this situation where, like, I'm going to be, I like the idea of everybody growing. Now, obviously, if there are ways in which you can cut the middleman out, like I think that before I made knives, I used to go up the street to this break and shear place for this job that I was working on when I was working in this metal shop. And we were making parts for buildings and exteriors and stuff like that. And it was this giant place where they would laser cut out your parts and then they had a break and shear to make your all that stuff. And all of a sudden when I started to see all these different CNC machines, I thought, how long is it going to take before these guys are out of business? Frankly, they make stuff too big for a garage guy to make. But at the same time, I am concerned with the fact that all these industries are going to be out of business. It does concern me. Cause I mean, at some point people got to work too, you know?
Right.
But I don't know, man.
Go ahead.
I don't know.
You were in the middle.
I don't know what else to say. I am concerned with technology taking away people's jobs.
Sure.
I am.
So if we look at the knife industry, right? There are gigantic countries around the world, or sorry, companies around the world, hundreds of them, maybe thousands of them, who knows, mass producing knives.
Right.
Of all different styles. Folders to chef's knives to whatever, right? And if you look at us as in regards to the custom knife making industry or the handmade knife industry, we are kind of a model for how a select, if you're really truly passionate about the work, that you can carve out a place for yourself when there is already a massive industry of mass produced stuff. You can still carve a place for yourself as a hand maker or in regards to visual art, as a painter or as a sculptor. There will always be a place for somebody who does that stuff well. And I think this is kind of like what I was saying in past episodes, is just like, but the trick is part, the difficult part in the world we live in now is, building that kind of rapport with your potential customer base or audience to create kind of a brand and reputation and around yourself as the creative person that you individually are, and selling people, not even necessarily on the work. Obviously, some people are interested solely in the work, but also on who you are as a human being in the world.
No, I agree. I mean, that's like any business that we want to support. Oh, I have a fucking funny story. I'll wait till Craig comes back. It was in regards to some of this stuff, but I'll save it. I apologize. I totally agree with you. I mean, I honestly have never felt more optimistic towards people who make things and create like an artistic, handmade, small production stuff. I'm much more optimistic on them because there are now jobs that you used to think are undestroyable or destroyable. The medical industry now is going to be changing because they're going to be using AI to help deal with like rudimentary stuff that a nurse would do. And there's going to be a lot of jobs. There are going to be job losses there. There's federal workers aren't working anymore.
Or like a triage, like basic intake and all that.
Yeah,
shit.
Taking your blood pressure, doing this, doing that. There's going to be the medical industry is in the United States at least has always been like, how do we save money? If they can start implementing all these machines, they're going to be able to cut jobs in general. I mean, that was something I talked about with Riley Kirkpatrick, was that when my wife didn't want to go to medical school and she got a nurse, she's a nurse practitioner, and nurse practitioners when she started were huge because a nurse practitioner can prescribe just like a doctor. They can see patients just like a doctor, and they're cheaper than a doctor. So all these hospitals and clinics were getting up, all these nurse practitioners, and they were not, it didn't mean they didn't have to hire as many doctors. Right. So there's always going to be these situations where technology and opportunities, make certain things redundant. And I think that if you can create something that's yours and you create you create a brand and you create a pace, you can start to fight a little bit about these redundancies because you're not a nameless face.
Right. Well, and part of me wonders, like, the people in these positions and in these jobs that potentially are going to be replaced, how many of these people are in these jobs because that's truly what they're passionate about, or like it's just something that they've art or creating or whatever, drawing and being creative in that way is something that just came easy to them, and so it seemed like an easy job, but it's like, is it really their passionate pursuit? And like, I guess the same could be said about that with the means of just like earning a fucking income just so they can like live their life. Do they have to make a living, or are they just like absolutely driven to make a living from that job, or is it just a living that they're trying to earn and now they're potentially losing that job that they've maybe been in for decades and they got to figure out some new shit? Like, I don't know. It's just like, it's hard. Yeah. I don't know.
I think that that's a personal question to the person who's you're asking, and I think that some people take jobs.
Yeah, sure, that'll be a case thing.
Some people take. I mean, well, a lot of our listeners have jobs that the money's good. They're able to pay for their families. They're able to pay all for their expenses. It gives them enough money to get an anvil or get a Broadbeck or get a Even Heat, and then you have these opportunities where you can have a passion and you don't necessarily need to have your passion be your job. So that's just normal shit. But things are changing. I've got to figure something out, but at the same time, we also need, the bottom line, and I'll stop talking about this, is creative people need to see the big picture on some of this stuff. And I think they need to use their heads more. They need to see the big picture that it is, as Jeremy Spake says, it is insidious. And you're kneecapping people who this is their lives. So don't kneecap. All right. We can do more feedback. We can do another question. Here's one more, you know what? I'll save this for Craig.
Craig.
Let's get back to questions and get out of here. But before we get to questions, I wanna say one thing. if you are a knife maker and you're a chisel guy or you're an axe guy and you're looking at a different way to sharpen your knives, think about the Tormek. Tormek is a great machine. It's a water-cooled system where the wheel rotates at a very specific rate, and you can true the wheel to make sure that you don't have it turn into an egg. And it's got water, it's got the whole nine yards, and it really is, there's jigs, you don't have to use jigs. It's a very versatile machine for sharpening, and it's definitely worth checking out. And if you are at Blade Show this year, I don't know how I convinced them to come from Sweden. They're all coming from Sweden. You listeners, you better pull it together and buy a couple of Tormek's, because I'm going to look bad if you just like slam them. So go down to Tormek at Blade Show. Say hello. Say hi to Sebastian and to Carl and all Jack and all them guys. And check out Tormek, Tormek.com or Tormek_sharpening on Instagram. So we have more questions, or we have, if you wanted, it's up to you. We have more listener feedback. We'll save some of them more for Craig. And we have some audio questions. And we also, if you wanted, we have some full blast podcast weird news if you wanted to end.
Yeah, let's do some crossover.
Okay, guys, listen. On the full blast podcast, I'll have a certain, so after some of my guests come on the Full Blast podcast, after a couple of times, we don't have to do the origin anymore. We can just fuck around. So we'll do a half, how are you? What's going on? And half weird news. Ben Snoor is the king of weird news. Ain't no one better than Ben Snoor. So we do some weird news. Here is some ChatGPT weird news.
Okay.
This is everyone's jumping on the AI doll trend. What are their concerns? We could do that if you want. Does that sound good? Then there's another one. An AI generated model with more than 157,000 followers earns $15,000 a month. We can do that. You want to know the concerns about the Barbie like viral social trend?
Sure. Let's hear it.
All right. So guys, listen to me. Everyone's jumping on the AI doll trend, but what are the concerns? Oh, we covered that last week. So let's do the $15,000 a month.
Okay,
so a sexy Spanish model with wild pink hair and hypnotic eyes is raking in $15,000 a month, and she's not even real. Aitana Lopez has amassed a massive fan base of 157,000 strong thanks to her gorgeous snaps on social media, where she poses in everything from swimsuits and lingerie to workout wear and low-cut tops. Not bad for someone who doesn't exist. Spanish designer Ruben Cruz used artificial intelligence to help create an animated model that looks as real as possible, where even the most discerning eyes might miss the hashtag AI model. So they're not hiding it. Like, there's AIs in the name. Her Instagram handle is FIT_AITANA. Cruz, founder of the agency The Clueless, was struggling with the meager client base due to the logistics of working with real life influencers. So they decided to create their own influencer to use as a model for brands they're now working with. Aitana, who they came up with, and the virtual model can earn up to $1,500 for an ad featuring her image. Cruz said that Aitana had earned up to $15,000 a month, bringing an average of $4,480 a month. We did it so we could make a better living and not be dependent on other people who have egos, who have manias, and who make a lot of money by posing. Aitana now has a team that meticulously plans her life from week to week, plots out the places she will visit, and determines which photos will be uploaded to satisfy her followers. In the first month we received, we realized that people follow lives, not images. Since she's not alive, we had to give her a bit of reality so people could relate to her story in some way. So aside from appearing as a fitness enthusiast, her website also describes Aitana as outgoing and caring. She's a Scorpio, in case you wondered.
You know what that means.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Usually, especially in astrology, Scorpios are the most fiery in the bedroom.
Well, she doesn't exist.
So obviously, like, but that's, good. I imagine, why they made her a Scorpio.
Yeah, because that's for you when you got the five-finger discount. You know what I'm saying? You're roughing up the suspects. That's Scorpio. Your Scorpio is your left hand, dude. A lot of thought went into Aitana. We created her based on what the society likes most. We thought about the taste, the hobbies, the niches we've been trending all year. The pink hair and gamer side of Aitana is a result. So there you go. Aitana is also realistic that celebrities have even slid into her DMs. One day, a well-known Latin American actor texted her and asked her out. He had no idea Aitana didn't exist. The designers have created a second model, Maya, M-A-I-A, following the success.
Oh, wow.
So the good thing is the funny thing is like, it was obviously a joke. The funny thing is they have AI is in the first two letters of this person, of this creator's name, and people are just too stupid to realize it isn't a person.
Right. That's interesting.
What do you think of this?
I mean, it is weird, but I mean, if you can make money from it, then great.
But I mean, isn't that a sample? I mean, she has, there's one picture, she's got 21,266 likes. There are some people who do not realize that she's not real. And it looks fake. Like, I've seen Instagram models where all of a sudden they're moving in this way that every particular movement part of their bodies looks kind of on the real side. And then all of a sudden one, you'll glitch up and see a sixth finger. And then all of a sudden you'll kind of realize it. But so many people don't realize that stuff. People just would be like, man, I want to date her. Meanwhile, it was created by some dude named Ruben, which is fucking weird too. Well, but I mean, it's just like when guys are like getting all horned up from AI images created by other men. I mean, that's like fucking bizarre.
It's like the lady in red from The Matrix when they're doing the training programs.
What's that?
Oh. When Neo is doing the training program, he's first removed from the Matrix, and then he's learning about the Matrix and training and learning Kung Fu and all that shit. The programmers that wrote the training program put a lady in red in one of the programs. And then he was like, I can arrange a more intimate interaction with her if you like. But
I'm glad that this guy isn't just they're very like tongue in cheek, making it very clear that this is not a real person. But it's like it is weird, and it just shows you how people are in regards to how they see these things. Mm. It is concerning to a certain degree, just because people are so stupid. But I have a very important article to read for you based off of your eyeballs. Man who burnt his thumb while cooking. Shocked to wake up and find both legs needed to be amputated.
What the fuck?
You ready?
Yeah.
A man has told his horror after what he thought was a minor burn on his thumb led him to him losing both his legs. Max Armstrong spent 6 days in a coma following a near-fatal accident he had while camping with his pals in Colorado. The 40-year-old headed out to the wilderness for a week with his friends for a fun outdoor getaway. Then he burnt his thumb while cooking pasta for dinner. I grabbed the skillet wrong, and my thumb touched the hot part. I could feel it burning as I moved it to the table, but I didn't want to drop it. Okay. I didn't think much of it because I've gotten burns and scrapes and cuts before living in the outdoors and being an outdoors person my whole life. After finishing up cooking, he cleaned up his wound before bandaging it up. But a couple of days later, Armstrong began to notice that one of his legs started to swell up. He initially brushed it off, but he didn't think the pain was that significant at the time. He believed he had unknowingly hurt his ankle some point. However, by December 7th, he was ready to pack up in his tent and call it a day. I decided to head home, and my buddy suggested I go to the hospital. At that point, my toenail started turning purple, and the swelling had increased. Baffled to why his lower limbs were swelling up, Armstrong headed to the hospital. And at this point, the burn on my thumb had become pretty ugly and it turned black. And it looked like it had been eating away at my thumb.
Whoa.
He sat down to discuss this bizarre syndrome with his doctors. The business owner explained that his eyes began to roll in the back of his head while he started talking nonsense. Guy started fucking losing it. Medics realized that strep A bacteria had infiltrated the burn in his thumb and quickly developed into sepsis, which can be a life-threatening if not treated properly. Armstrong was transported to another facility better suited to his needs before the doctors placed him into an induced coma for 6 days. His loved ones were all ready to prepare for the worst, but miraculously he regained consciousness. Everyone was very happy to see me. The doctors told me that I might not make it and was concerned that I wouldn't wake up. My family was extremely happy, and I could hear them cheering. The mood of elation quickly disintegrated when Armstrong noticed that his feet were both completely black. The doctors informed him that they would need to amputate his limbs. He explained that while he was in a coma, the sepsis had completely eaten away at his feet and started spreading into his legs, meaning it was impossible for them to be saved. So he underwent a three-hour procedure, amputated both his legs, and spent more than a month recovering in hospital. That's not good.
Ouch.
What's the moral of the story?
Clean your wounds.
Use a fucking side towel when you pick up the goddamn pants. Yeah. I mean, that is like day one
towel,
shit.
What,
side towel, your sock, use your underwear, whatever it takes. You know, grab your old underwear, man, whatever it takes. Initially, when I woke up, I thought my legs were still there, and I came out and realized they weren't. I felt down my leg, and I realized that my legs weren't there. She told me the family was waiting, and they keep reminding them which keep on reminding me of which they which anchored me. He will now have to rely on a wheelchair for the rest of his life, and he's keen to become a pro at triceps and shoulder exercises, which will help him his mobility. It was a hunting trip with friends and turned into a bit of a nightmare. Yeah, bit of a nightmare, I should say. Sadly, dinner was enough for the burn to get strep A. So that's bad.
It's not clear. So is that something that you just pick up in the environment, or just like he didn't properly clean his wound and then?
Don't know. I mean, strep A sounds like, you know, I mean, I think it's just like a bacterial infection. I think you can get bacterial infections, and some people are just more close to getting those kind of bacterial infections. But I mean, that is like, you want to talk about, like, you know, people listen to this podcast, they are the, just put some fucking, just spit on it, rub some dirt on it, put some electric tape on it and get back to work. Next thing you know, it's like, hey, by the way, can I take them legs? All them legs you've been standing on for a while? Yeah, you don't need those anymore. What are you talking about? Yeah, you got sepsis from that fucking, you know, electric tape you strapped on your fucking thumb.
Christ.
There you go.
Ugh.
Well, so it could be. So, I mean, so all the eye stories aren't that bad. So, guys, I mean, you know, Ian much better than that.
Yeah, so it says strep A sepsis or streptococcal sepsis is a life-threatening condition where group A streptococcus bacteria enter the bloodstream and cause severe systemic infection, potentially leading to organ damage and failure.
Mm. Oof. Don't do it. Christ. Ladies and germs.
Common bacteria infection.
That really does give another layer to when I say ladies and germs. I mean, you don't fucking lose your fucking legs. Goddamn. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he just stayed in the woods for a long time. Like, it happened. And then he was just like, oh, it'll be fine. And then his thumb started turning black and his fucking toes started turning black. I think at some point you need to like know when to say when.
Yeah. Crazy.
Well, that was uplifting.
Yeah. Thanks for
super
that.
Super uplifting. Yeah, you're
welcome. I mean, I feel better about where I'm at.
You should feel better. Hey, that's what we do here. We bring it back, guys.
I mean,
don't worry about
that. Sorry for that guy, but.
Don't worry about that. I mean, I could have told you a fucking story. I could have been told you a story about like guys who, you know, fart their, you know, sell farts in the jars. It's weird news because it's fucking weird, dude.
Yeah.
We did a whole thing with Ben on this dude who built a $14,000 dog suit so he could be a real dog. You know about that guy?
Oh, yeah.
His name's Toko. His name's Toko. Well, so we had a whole thing,
through the suit?
Well, we don't know about the intimacies, but here's where it gets interesting. So he had a nice following. He built this amazing suit. He looked like a fucking real dog. And then recently he started his own zoo for people to live out their fantasies of being a dog. So you have renting out your dog, different dog suits. And you can go in there. You pay
like a hotel? Or is it like
no, a, it's a it's zoo. Like... And you do fucking tricks. You go in. You give them $250. You give them $250. They give you the dog suit. You romp around with other people in dog suits, wackos, and then you know, you probably we were talking about
no
it.
Shaming, no judgment.
No, of course not. We came up with the conclusion that it was probably like some Japanese police officer said, "Hey, chief, I have this great idea for getting people off the streets. Let's come up with a zoo." So there's like it's like those things where you know you see those guys who have like drunk driving records or something like that, and they get a letter in the mail saying, hey, you want a cruise? And they walk through the door, and they say, hey, sign your name, right? And they go through the doors, and they lock them up. We kind of figured out that it was kind of a situation like that. But look, the guy's happy, you know? Could be worse.
Living his best life.
Living his best life, guys. We're going to go to the after show, but we hit everything. I appreciate the hell out of you. Craig, we're going to see you next week, and let's do a little after show. So thanks again, and... Oy vey, Shmir. There you go. What else? Watching anything good or no?
I haven't really been watching anything. I've been watching the sunset. I've been just trying to catch the sunset more as much as I can, especially on these beautiful days. It's
nice.
Stunning. Across the harbor and all the sailboats and up across the hills. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's absolutely
What's the
beautiful.
Best seafood you get around by your house? You get any good seafood? It's like seafood town, right?
Just about anything I see, I like to eat.
No, I know. Ha ha, seafood, I eat food. No, but like, what kind of maritime food do you eat? I mean, you're like, are there a lot of crabs over there? What are you eating over there?
Yeah. There's lots of crab, a lot of shellfish. I actually got a buddy who's got, I have a couple of different friends that have oyster farms. So lots of oysters. A lot of shellfish, crustacean, fish, salmon, mostly salmon.
What kind of crabs?
We got Dungeness, we got Red Rock crabs, and those
are they good?
Yeah.
Never had them. They're
considered, I think Dungeness or at least are considered some of the best in the world.
I've never had any of that shit. We didn't eat crab. Growing up, we had blue crabs, but they were such a giant pain in the ass to clean that you're still hungry by the time you've finished them.
Were those the soft shell though?
The soft shell crabs are the recently where they slough off their shell and they're in the soft state. It actually reminds me, my man Luke McFadden just sent me a package of all sorts of stuff from Maryland. I think he sent me some crab cakes.
Oh damn!
So I'm got a message saying there's some crab cakes on the way. So I'm looking forward to a little crab action. But growing up, I never ate that shit. My dad didn't do crab. We had soft shell crabs and that was about it. I never ate crabs. We rarely, lobster was such a rarity. Never really ate that either.
Really? Yeah.
Not really. Once in a while.
Yeah. Our Dungeness is like New England lobster, basically.
Wow.
I mean, it's different, but similar.
Are they easy to get a hold of and they're inexpensive or is it a production?
I mean, they're easy to get a hold of, but they're not necessarily inexpensive. But they're really easy to like cook up and clean and eat the meat and all that stuff. It's actually quite enjoyable.
So, if you were, how often would you eat a Dungeness crab?
It's actually been a couple of years since the last time I had Dungeness.
Okay.
You can get a license. You can set out crab pots. you can come back the next day and you can have pots full of crabs and you can have. One time we went out on a boat and I think my buddy was anticipating there being a lot of crabs in the pots. And so he made sure that there were like six or seven people on the fucking boat. So each of us had our limit. Cause I think at least for the Dungeness, you can do five males. You can take five males a day and they have to be 6.5 inches wide. And then the rock crab, I think is, at least for the males is unlimited. And then,
How much is like a, if you were to go to the store, how much would it have done? It was Dungeness for one person? One?
Yeah, one
crab.
Or
was it a couple people?
Yeah, you could probably split it between two people, but I'm a bottomless pit for seafood, so I would probably eat at least one, maybe two.
That's fair. So how much do you think a Dungeness crab costs in season? $20? God.
Yeah. Maybe. It's not too crazy. It's fucking delicious.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't. I'm for it. The opportunities have never really presented themselves for any of that stuff. I don't really.
You ever get out here in the Northwest and take you out to eat all the Northwestern fare?
I'll take you up on that. We'll get a bunch of fucking crabs and hit them in the head with a. I guess you hit them in the head with a.
You don't
anchor or a baseball bat. You don't hit them in the head.
The dispatching them is actually kind of gnarly. You basically just.
I don't want to know. All right.
Break them in half.
Oh, you don't just fucking smash him in the head with a baseball bat?
Yeah, no.
Fair enough. All right, guys, listen. That was fun. I don't know why I did that again. God damn it. God damn it. So with that said, go Knicks. This is me talking to the universe here. I mean, it's you got to fucking do whatever it takes, New York Knicks, because you're driving me crazy. And Mareko, is always great speaking with you.
You too.
And we'll see Craig next week, and we'll see you, the listeners, next week. So here's your chance, guys. If you want to send in messages, voicemail, voice messages or anything, go to follow us on Instagram, Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. And if you could, go to where you listen to this and give us a 5-star review, subscribe, tell your friends, and thank you very much. And we'll see you next week. Bye, man.
Bye.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.